Yeah, welcome. My name is Georg Fierser. I'm a research lecturer with the department here, but I'm not a nuclear physicist, so my disclaimer, nothing I tell you today will be in any way secret or forbidden or whatever. Nothing what I say will get you or me into jail. I'm a particle physicist. So, if you talk about the physics of the bomb, we need to understand first a little bit about the physics of the nucleus. So the first thing I want to do is just introduce to you who is actually a player in the nucleus. And so we'll start with the proton. The proton has a positive charge and is obviously required to balance the negative charge of the electrons. Yeah? We know about the proton for a fairly long time because of this charge argument, and actually the first person to show that there are these things like protons was Rutherford, and this is 1917. Just for future use, we will use the letter Z to tell us how many of those protons will be in a nucleus. And the other big player is the neutron. Neutron, as it says in the name, is electrically neutral. Took us much longer to sort of understand the existence of the neutron, and it was confirmed in 1932 as a free particle by a British physicist, Chadwick. Again, we use a letter to count the number of neutrons in a nucleus. We call this N, and they both together are what we call the mass number, and we write this with the letter A. Now, one thing to note is, we call these two the nucleons, and these are the particles which are inside the nucleus. And one thing to notice, which is very interesting and has huge repercussions for the world we are living in, is that apart from the charge, these two are actually very, very similar. Yeah? For example, they have the same size, they have very similar mass, so all its properties are very similar, contrary to the electron, which is very different. Yeah? It's much, much smaller than the protons and the neutrons. Now, because they are so similar in properties, they can easily change into each other by a process which we call beta decay. So the next thing we want to understand is what keeps those protons and neutrons together in the nucleus. It cannot be electromagnetism, because we are binding a neutral particle. It also cannot be gravity, because gravity is too weak. So none of our existing easily recognizable forces are of any relevance here, and we have to actually introduce a new force, a nuclear force. Nuclear force is fantastically difficult. Yeah? Not even our undergraduates really learn how to deal with that one, and even very advanced physicists cannot really deal with it in a good way. But for the discussions here, I will use two very simple features. The first one is this nuclear force doesn't distinguish between protons and neutrons. It treats them absolutely the same. Yeah? The second thing is that this force keeps two nucleons always at a fixed distance, or very much close to a fixed distance. And that distance is around 2 femtometers. Yeah? So just to give you an idea how much this is when you write it in meters, you have 15 zeros. And to give you a scale, after 6 zeros, you hit the size of a human hair. After another about 3 to 4 zeros, you've hit the size of a soap film. Then after 10 zeros, you hit the size of an atom. And then finally, you get to the dimension of these nuclear interactions, which is about 5 orders of magnitude smaller than the size of an atom. But because of the fact that this nuclear force likes to keep these forces at exactly that distance, it is actually useful to come up with an image where we treat these two as spherical hard balls, which stay in contact with each other. And then when you sort of spin this thought further, if you always have this same distance, then you can build up a whole nucleus out of lots of these little balls, and they're all in touch with each other at a scale of 2 femtometers. So The main thing now for any nuclear energy, where is it coming from? The nuclear energy comes from the binding energy of these nucleons. So what we will find is we will have a nucleus with a lower binding energy, something happens to it, and it will change into a nucleus with a higher binding energy. And the difference between these two binding energies is the gain we get in terms of nuclear energy. So now I will drag you through the only equation I give you tonight, which is an equation which tries to parameterize how this binding energy is now sort of how it's made up of various contributions. So we will build an equation, and we'll also look at what this equation actually says in this kind of diagram. In the diagram, we will show the binding. So we'll show the binding energy as a function of the size of the nucleus. Yeah. So to the left will be small nuclei, and then as we go to the right, they will become larger and larger. So the first thing we will do. Before I do that, I need to also introduce a unit of energy in nuclear physics, and the unit which we'll use here is the mega electron volt. Just to give you an idea for how big a mega electron volt is, if you drop a hair, which is about 10 to minus 7 kilograms, and you drop it by the thickness of one hair, you have just now liberated 3,000 MeV of energy. Yeah? So now, usually it doesn't happen that if you drop a hair, you create a nuclear explosion. So why is that? This is because in the nucleus, the energy is extremely concentrated. Yeah? But just to give you the scale, on a global scale, this energy is small. On a nuclear scale, it is actually quite large. So now, let's think about what makes the binding energy in such a nucleus. The first thing we noticed, we said all these nuclei are densely packed. So if I densely pack a lot of spheres, this is now two-dimensional or three-dimensional, but you get the idea, you will always find the same number of nucleons around you. Yeah? So six in this case, six in this case, six in this case. Yeah? So that means we will have a term which essentially will be proportional to just the number of nucleons we have in the nucleus. We call this the volume term. And when I divide the binding energy by the number of nucleons, what I get is that I get this constant term CV. But I've made a mistake now. Yeah, I've overcounted, because there will be some of the nucleons on the outer edge, and those will not have six neighbors, but they only have four neighbors. Yeah? So I have to take something off now to compensate for that one. And this is proportional to the surface. And why this goes with a to the 2 over 3, you probably can figure out yourself if you just think about 3 minutes about it. And what this means is that now this binding energy per nucleus is dramatically reduced for very small nuclei. Why? Because the surface is very large compared to its volume. And the reduction is less important for larger nuclei. So the next term is, we said we have protons and neutrons inside the nucleus. Yeah? The protons are positively charged, and they electrostatically repulse each other. Yeah? So they will push out and will tend to break the nucleus apart. So this we account for with what we call the Coulomb term. Yeah? So the more protons there are in the nucleus, the more sort of this will tend to reduce the binding energy. Yeah? And so this gives us now a reduction, particularly for large nuclei, where there are lots of protons. So if we would stop here, the world would be a rather boring place, because then it would be very obvious that the energetically most favorable situation would be that we only have neutrons. Yeah? Then we don't have any Coulomb repulsion, everything is fine. Yeah? Which would be rather boring, because then we wouldn't be sitting here. No chemistry, no biology. So luckily, God has invented quantum mechanics, and there are two terms which now come from quantum mechanics, and we can't discuss the details here, but just to give you an idea, the first one is what we call the asymmetry term. It turns out nature favors nuclei which have the same amount of neutrons and protons in it. Yeah, so in my little dummy play nucleus here, I have, I think, 9 protons and 10 neutrons. So that's about the same, yeah? And you can see that this is proportional to n minus z. So the more the difference, the bigger the difference between N and Z is, the bigger this reduction is. And then there's a final term, and that's called what we call the pairing term. It turns out in the nucleus, if you just look at protons, if you just look at neutrons, they like to pair up in pairs. Yeah? And so in my little dummy nucleus that works perfectly for the neutrons, they're all in pairs, and one odd proton is sticking out. Yeah? And so this gives us a last term, which is positive if I have even neutrons, even protons, negative if you have odd, and zero if I'm in between. So this equation was developed by various peoples, but is commonly attributed to a German physicist von Weizsäcker in 1935. So you can see already we're getting closer and closer to the timeline of the Oppenheimer movie. One thing which we can notice now with all these various terms as they have built up is when we look at the resulting binding energy per nucleon, we see now that it starts at very low values, and as the nuclei become bigger, it increases, and then there's a maximum where iron is. Yeah? And so the biggest binding energy we will have in iron. And so that means in the long run, the expectation is this is the best bound nucleus, and this is where everything will go towards. Yeah? Now, if you have very large nuclei out here, we have uranium, and the uranium will now tend to, uranium is a very large nucleus, and energetically it's better for it to break up into smaller units, and this is what we call fission. This is what we are going to talk about today. So let's look a little bit more into fission. It starts with a big nucleus, and a big nucleus will start to separate, and it will separate into two daughter nuclei. Yeah? The first thing we can notice, because you're now experts already in nuclear binding energy, what happens in the process is at the beginning, the surface of the nucleus will increase. So you will get an increased reduction of the binding energy due to the surface effect. So what this means is at the beginning, I have to put energy in, yeah, to start splitting, pulling apart the nucleons in the nucleus. But once I get to the point where you have now these two daughter nuclei formed. Yeah, so for uranium, just to make this point, for uranium, that energy I have to put in is about 5 MeV. But once I've formed these two daughter nuclei and the surface is not increasing anymore, then I get a massive gain because now these two nuclei will electrostatically repulse each other. And so I get a lot of energy out from this Coulomb force. So what do we have to do to split the nucleus? Well, the first thing is we have to put a small amount of energy, 5 MeV, we have seen is a very small amount of energy, but we have to put it into a very tight space. So before I do that, I want to also explain a little bit more about uranium. Yeah? Now, the first thing here which we need to notice if we talk about nuclei, that the relevant parameter in terms of charge is the number of protons. That's what drives the chemistry of any element I make with these nuclei. But you could have a varying number of neutrons and would not affect the chemistry. And this indeed happens, and we call these nuclei with different number of neutrons, we call these isotopes. Because they're essentially in the same place in the periodic table of elements. Now, uranium. Uranium is a very dense metal. It's about 2.5 as dense as iron. It's radioactive, but not very strongly, which means it actually survives for a very long time, and you can actually find it. You can dig it out of the ground. Usually, you can find it in the form of an ore, which is called pitch blende. We know uranium for a long time, since the 18th century, where a German chemist has for the first time isolated it. And it's a good friend of the physicists because it was, for example, used by Becquerel, or let's say Becquerel stumbled over a piece of uranium which exposed one of its photographic plates. And this was our first indication that there's such a thing like radioactivity in nature. Now, the uranium nucleus has 92 protons. But it has several isotopes, and the most prominent ones are one isotope which is 143 neutrons and one which is 146 neutrons. And so there is two isotopes. One is called uranium-235, The number here is the atomic mass number, so the sum of the number of protons and neutrons. And then you have uranium-238 as the other isotope. If you dig out natural uranium out of the ground, what you'll find is that it has 99.3% uranium-238 and about 0.7% of the uranium-235. So now we have seen we need to put a little bit of energy into a nucleus to get a fission going. So the question is now, how can we transfer the energy into this nucleus? And a suitable vehicle is just use a neutron. Yeah, shoot a neutron into the nucleus, and that will give it now the energy to go above this fission barrier. So let's do that. Yeah, let's start with uranium-238. Let's take a neutron, shoot a neutron into this uranium-238, and if the neutron is high energy, so let's say 6 MeV, then obviously energy conservation, the energy ends up in the nucleus, and that is enough to lift us over this barrier, and we will have induced a fission event. If our neutron wouldn't be so fast, it wouldn't have that energy, then it just would be insufficient to get us across this barrier. Yeah. So if I would shoot a neutron, a slower neutron, into uranium-238, it will not create fission, but essentially the nucleus will de-excite by emission of a photon. Now, if we do the same game with uranium-235, something funny is happening. Because if I shoot now a low-energy neutron into uranium-235, something happens which shouldn't happen, yeah? Namely, you create fission. So what is happening? Now the pesky little pairing term comes into play. Yeah? So what happens is the uranium-235 is a nucleus which has even set and odd end. So if you shoot another neutron into it, it changes from an odd end nucleus into an even end nucleus, and we have seen this gives us better binding energy. Yeah? And so that binding energy is now available. And it turns out it's good enough to kick now this uranium nucleus over that fission barrier. And this is a general feature of nuclei which have an even number of Z and an odd number of neutrons. We call these fissile. And another example of this one is plutonium. We'll come back to that one in a moment. So, next slide, sorry, is slow. So, the next thing we want to notice is when we look at nuclei, of course. No. So this is graphic heavy, this slide, so that is slow. Yeah, so here we are. So what I'm doing now is I'm looking at nuclei in the plane of N and Z. Yeah? And we have seen before, when we looked at the different contributions to the binding energy, there was this asymmetry term. And if I just would have the asymmetry term, it would tend to get the number of protons and neutrons to the same value. Yeah? So this would be the red line in that curve. However, it turns out, because of the Coulomb interaction, this curve, the curve the nuclei will really follow is now this green curve. And what you can see is that the larger nucleus becomes the more neutron-rich it has to be. Yeah? The neutrons act as a glue, basically, to keep these positive charges which repel each other together. Yeah? So uranium is out there. I've indicated it. And so now what happens if this uranium nucleus splits is it has a lot of neutrons, which it requires because it's big. But it now splits into something which is smaller. So it now has too many neutrons. So what actually then happens is that some of those neutrons will just be spit out by that fission process. So for uranium, that's typically about 2 to 3 neutrons, as you can see. Yeah? So the uranium nucleus receives a neutron. The neutron now brings it up to even, and then it breaks apart here into barium and krypton, and you have these three individual fission neutrons. And also the daughter particles will subsequently decay by beta decay. Now this process, fission, was discovered by Hahn and Strassmann in 1938 and explained by Meitner and Fritsch. And when this was done, this was the start of the race. Yeah, this was the point where people started to see that this can lead to a nuclear chain reaction. Yeah, because what happens now is in this fission process, you generate about 200 MeV. This predominantly goes into these two recoiling daughter nuclei because they repel each other because of the charge. And you have these three neutrons. These three neutrons now, they get a small amount of energy because they're neutral. Yeah? It's not enough to fission to uranium-238, but it's enough to fission uranium-235. Yeah? And here is the starting point of the chain reaction. And this was something, an idea which was conceived by a Hungarian physicist, Szilard, in 1933 while he was crossing a traffic light in London. Famous story. So what are the challenges of building a bomb? The first one, we said, this works with uranium-235, but not with 238. So we have to enrich the material. We have to basically remove all the uranium-238 so that we can only, we have left 235, and we can do this chain reaction. So this is enrichment. Fantastically difficult, yeah, because uranium-235 and 238 really have nothing, not a lot, which distinguishes them. There's a small mass difference. So really what you have to do is you have to find physical processes how you can separate these two slightly different nuclei. So this was clearly a challenge for Manhattan Project. Three different approaches were taken. Gas diffusion, so you can transfer change uranium into a gas by combining it with fluor, and you get your own hexafluoride. And this gas diffuses through some barriers with a slightly different speed for the two diisotopes. Next one was electromagnetic separation. You can use the fact that the nuclei have a slightly different inertia, and so you can accelerate them and then look at the slightly different inertia in this acceleration. And the last one they used is liquid thermal diffusion. When you have a mixture of two gases which passes through a temperature gradient, the heavier gas tends to concentrate at the cold end and the lighter gas at the warm end. Fantastically difficult, and I will show you in a moment how difficult or how big this was. None of them was easy. In the end, they used all three technologies sequentially. But before I go to showing you the facilities, a word about plutonium. We said this is also a fissile material. It doesn't exist in nature. It decays too quickly. So, but you can produce uranium in a reactor by absorbing a neutron with a 238 uranium, and then you have two beta decays, and then you end up with this fissile plutonium. Highly radioactive and toxic. It's a really, really nasty material, apart from that you can use it to build a bomb. Yeah? And was first produced in 1940. Yeah? So we are now already in the middle of the discussion of the Oppenheimer movie. One key milestone in the Manhattan Project was, therefore, that they could build the first controlled chain reaction in a reactor, and this was at the Chicago Pile 1, the first nuclear reactor in the history of mankind. And this was December 1942. And then for the production, new reactors were built. The first one which may produce plutonium in any sizable amount was a reactor in Oak Ridge, and then the plutonium for the Trinity bomb and the Fat Man bomb was produced in Hanford. Now, one problem with plutonium is that this uranium-239, which is fissile, is often contaminated with another isotope of plutonium, which is 240, has one more neutron, and therefore has a tendency to spontaneously fission. And that's a problem when you build a bomb. We'll come to this one in a moment. And the other thing is actually plutonium is a nasty material. It's also quite difficult to handle the metallurgy. So just to give you now an indication of the effort which were involved in this Manhattan Project. Manhattan Project comprised facilities all over the US. The first sort of cluster of important facilities was at Oak Ridge, because here is where the uranium enrichment took place. And so this was the S50 was the plant where liquid, the thermal diffusion was performed, which was the first stage of the enrichment process. Then it was sent to the gas diffusion plant. This is K25. Yeah? And this is an absolutely enormous beast. This was the largest building in the whole world at the time. Yeah? Biggest floor space which ever has has existed in a building. You can see 800 meters long. Yeah, would take you about 10 minutes to walk from one end to the other. And then finally, you have the electromagnetic separation in a facility which is called Y-12. All of those were located in Oak Ridge in Tennessee. So this is for the uranium enrichment. Where do we get the plutonium from? We said the plutonium is reactor bred. So they built three reactors for plutonium brooding, and those were in Hanford. So this is Washington State. But this is only the first step, because then you have to separate the plutonium from the rest of the nuclear core. So you also need a chemical separation plant. And there were three of them, each of them 250 meters long, which was about the size of the Queen Mary ocean liner at the time. So that's why they were called Queen Marys. The whole of Manhattan Project employed nearly 130,000 people at its peak, and not physicists, absolutely not, no construction workers who had to build all these facilities. Cost at the time $2 billion, and this is in the time of a global war with its commitments, equivalent to about $24 billion today. So 90% of the effort of Manhattan Project was not in Los Alamos, was not in what we have seen in the Oppenheimer movie, but were these facilities all over the U.S. Only less than 10% was actually then spent in Los Alamos. So next critical question is, how much of that stuff do we need? Yeah, and this is actually still from the movie. You might have remembered this one scene where he throws these glass marbles into these balls and might have asked himself, why is that? Is it just play? Like, does he like to play marbles? No. There's a meaning. You need to have a minimum amount of fissile material to make this work. If you don't, then as you see here in the small ball here, you start the fission reaction, but all these precious neutrons which you produce in this fission reaction, they just go out of the surface of the material. It's lost, no chain reaction. So you need a minimum size for it. The bare sphere critical mass at normal density for your uranium-235 is 52 kilograms, a sphere of 17 centimeters. So this is what in the movie was the big ball. And for plutonium, it's much less, it's about 10 kilograms, just much smaller. The first estimates for the critical mass for these fissile materials, or actually for uranium-235, was done in Britain in 1933 by Frisch and Piles. And Piles has a connection to this university, this department here. Obviously, these calculations are very difficult, so it had to be backed up by experiments, and these were the places of the first radiation accidents in history. Now, how does the blast develop? After 80 generations of chain reaction, and this occurs in less than a microsecond, to give you a feeling, the blink of an eye is about 350,000 microseconds. So at a much, much shorter time scale than a blink of an eye, we go through 80 generations of this chain reaction. What does this do? After 80 generations, I get 10 to the 24 fission events. Yeah, so this is, you might know this story with this Indian story with the rice corn and the chessboard. And you get every time, it's just the powers of two. Yeah. So if you have 80 powers of two, that's a big number and becomes macroscopic. Yeah. It involves now half a kilogram of fissile material at this point. The energy released, so we just take now these 10 to the 24 fission events, multiply it with the 200 MeV we get out of a single fission event, which was very small, but now we have so many of those, gives us 40 terajoule, which is equivalent to the explosive power of 10 kilotons of TNT. Yeah? So we are here now at the bomb level. The energy goes mostly into kinetic energy of the daughter nuclei, and because the material is so dense, they will bump into other nuclei, and essentially this whole energy will go into heat. But heat doesn't flow very quickly. So that heat gets stuck in that heavy core. Yeah? And so what happens now is, because you create so much heat in that heavy core, is this drives up the temperature to enormous values, to tens of millions of degrees C. Yeah? This is hotter than the temperature of the outside of the sun. It's like the temperature of the sun in its core itself. Yeah? It's not stable. It just stays for a very, very short time, but it's an enormous temperature. And if something has such an enormous amount of temperature, What it does, it releases its energies, but now by shooting out photons, X-ray photons. And those X-ray photons will hit now other material, and when it because there are so many, they have such a high energy, they basically vaporize the material around it. And from that vaporization, you get a shock wave. So how did this look like? So this is a picture actually still from the Trinity explosion. After 1/40th of a second, this blast wave has now achieved a diameter of about 200, 300 meters. And you can see this well, nicely defined shock wave from this blast, which has been produced by the vaporization of the material by the X-rays. Or you can also find videos on YouTube on some other tests with about a similar yield, but now a thermonuclear weapon, which is a completely different story. But the basic thing is the same. You get a very quick release of a lot of energy in a small volume, and this produces these type of shock waves. Main effects of the nuclear bomb are 50% of the energy go into the blast, 35% into thermal energy, prompt ionizing radiation 5%, and delayed ionizing radiation is 10%. So what was the last big challenge for building the bomb is actually how you fire it up. Before you ignite the bomb, what you want is you don't want the bomb to explode when you carry it in the airplane to the place where you want to use it. So what you do is you separate the material into smaller pieces, which are all below critical. And then when you fire the bomb, you unite them into a supercritical mass, and then hopefully, if your bomb works, this is where the chain reaction takes place. Now, the problem here is, the technical problem is, that if the chain reaction starts, that immediately releases a lot of energy, and the material starts to separate already during that process. So you need to keep the materials sufficiently long together that a full-blown chain reaction takes place. If you don't manage this, you get a fizzle. But even in a bomb which does work reasonably well, only a fraction of the material actually has time to be part of the chain reaction. So in Trinity bomb, there were 6 kilograms of plutonium and 1 kilogram fission. So the simplest thing how you can do that is now you can use a gun-type bomb, which is suitable for uranium-235 only, because it's actually too slow for plutonium. Conceptually and technically rather simple, therefore not considered a challenge by the physicists in Los Alamos. But has one drawback, that it requires a lot of highly valuable enriched uranium-235, and is also not very efficient. That bomb had about 64 kilo of fissile material, and only 1 kilogram was used. But unfortunately, it was indeed used, and it was used for the Hiroshima bomb. For plutonium, the thing is much more complicated. We have seen is this pesky plutonium-240, which tends to sort of induce fission too quickly, too early. Yeah? And you would run a risk that your bomb blows up or fizzles before you want to use it. Yeah? So they had to find a more clever approach, and this was used in the Trinity test and also in the bomb used then on Batman. And the idea is basically you have now a spherical assembly with the fissile material in the center, and you have a conventional explosive which surrounds that one, and that drives a shock wave to the center, compresses the core, and this compression now reduces the reduced mass, and that is then what makes the whole thing supercritical. Now, this is technically difficult. It's not difficult because it's difficult nuclear physics. This is difficult because it's chemistry and explosive technology. Yeah, and this is what a lot of time was spent on in Los Alamos to get this right. Yeah. You don't only have the fissile core here. You also use actually a very heavy metal. And they had lots of uranium lying around, so they could use that one to sort of drive that explosion and keep it long enough together because of this very massive material. This is what we call a tamper. Now, as we have seen, the required critical mass for plutonium is not a lot. 6 kilograms is enough, something of that size. But what makes the whole thing big is now this arrangement of the tamper around it and then the explosive. And the firing mechanism and all these things. So this is a picture of the Trinity device You can see it's about 2 meters in diameter. Why is it so big? Well, because of all these additional features. The actual fissile core was not bigger than a grapefruit. Nevertheless, this became then the standard fundamental geometry for all other nuclear bombs which have been built after that one. And the challenge then was basically to make this 2 meter device smaller so that we can more easily place it on other delivery vehicles. So my last slide now. You have seen when you have watched Oppenheimer, there was a huge motivation for the physicists working on that project because they were afraid that Hitler would get his nuclear bomb first. You have also seen that quite a lot of the nuclear physics was actually driven by German physicists, so this fear was not totally unwarranted. But what has happened is that a lot of the very capable physicists were pushed out of Germany, moved to the US, and became part of the Manhattan Project. Now, there have been a few people who stayed behind. Heisenberg, you probably know. Weizsäcker, you have seen, he was involved in this binding energy formula. Hahn, who found fission in uranium. So they stayed on. And they did work on a German nuclear program, even though the regime was not particularly friendly to modern physics concepts. There were a lot of sort of niches where these people could get money from, and the army actually was supporting this to some extent. So why did this effort never go anywhere? Well, the first one is too many of the good physicists have left the country. The group which was left in Germany was just not big enough. And not only was it not big enough, also quite a few of them hated each other's guts. Yeah, and so they were not capable of working together. Very, very, very different than the spirit which happened in Los Alamos, as you might have seen in the movie. Now, the next thing is, fundamentally, the German physicists did not believe that a bomb would be possible on the timescale of the World War. This is partially caused because they made several mistakes. The first one is they overestimated the critical mass required for such a bomb. They never did a proper calculation. They didn't have friction piles. The second misconception that they had is they didn't think that a graphite reactor would be possible, like the graphite reactor which Fermi has built in Chicago in 1942. So they were bound to work with another material which is called heavy water. So their focus was therefore not on building a bomb, but what they wanted to achieve was achieving a sustained chain reaction. And they basically wanted to sell this to the army as a good source of energy. So that's what was their goal. They tried until the last days of the war, they tried to achieve that, but failed. Part of the reason why they failed is because due to the effort of several players all over the world, access to the key materials, uranium and heavy water, was limited or interrupted. And ultimately, the regime was never prepared to divert the industrial capacity, which you have seen is enormous, to that type of effort, and they rather preferred to pour that amount of effort into other weapons they thought are more promising. Now, my personal opinion is that by late 1943, it should have been amply clear that the Germans were not on the route to such a weapon, just because they would have seen if such large facilities would have been around. And by autumn of 1944, it was totally clear, because by that time the Allies had reached the Rhine, with no sign that anything like this happened. And they actually even had a measurement where they flew planes which were looking for xenon-133, which is an isotope which is emitted in nuclear reactions over Germany, and they couldn't find the signal. So this was evidence that no chain reaction had taken place in Germany. So, summary. Key points. The release of nuclear energy, the energy in the bomb, is caused by an increase in nuclear binding energy. And for large nuclei, this is achieved by reducing the size, by splitting it. The split rarely happens spontaneously, but you have to put some energy in to overcome this fission barrier, and that can come from a neutron. Fissile materials can be split by low-energy neutrons. Why? Because you get the energy from the pairing term. And so the key thing is now that you have to isolate that fissile material, either uranium-235 or plutonium. The daughter nuclei retain the high fraction of neutrons, and so this gives us these additional neutrons, and these neutrons then can sustain the chain reaction. For a functioning bomb, the fissile material, which is kept separately in parts, has to be united very, very quickly and has to be kept together for enough time for this chain reaction to develop. And the production of the required pure fissile material is an industrial operation. Yeah, and it's also it's difficult, not so much from the nuclear physics part of view, but there's difficult pathology. There is difficult the combination of these subcritical parts by the explosions is very, very difficult. So there were technical challenges which were not necessarily nuclear, but still very, very difficult. And this is what the movie is about. This is what happened in Los Alamos, where they tried to come to grips with those technical issues. Thank you.